common name and well-known around our part of the country, where he's grown up and where he's preached in various places, a very bright young man. In addition to that, he's a banker. It doesn't hurt to have a friend who's a banker. He has a great future as a preacher, I can tell you right now. Very great student of the Word, one of the finest young men I know. And he's done a wonderful job this morning.
Thank you.
If you have any questions, why? Raise your hand.
Nate, I appreciate your presentation. Your references to the Lord being the suffering servant is very good title for the Lord. He's a servant. Jesus said in Matthew 20 and verse 28, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life a ransom for many. And I think that serving is a part of the Lord's nature. I don't think it's just something that he just did for a time when he came to the earth. I think serving is part of his nature. And I don't think it ended when he ascended back into heaven. And I was just going to ask your opinion about this passage in Luke chapter 12 and verse 37. It says, blessed are those servants whom the master, when he comes, will find watching. Assuredly, I say to you, he will gird himself and will have them sit down to eat and will come and serve them. And, you know, I think we think that when the Lord ascended and when he comes again, he's going to be sitting on the throne and we're going to be all standing in front of him, serving him, and I suppose we will. I believe that we will. But I believe that also the Lord is going to continue being a servant and serve his people throughout eternity, and I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I think those are good points, and I wouldn't disagree with that at all. I think with Isaiah, and the point should probably be better made, Isaiah's prophecies of the servant are a clear progression to the suffering servant. He's introduced as the servant of God, but with each prophecy we learn more about his mission, and we learn that he is going to suffer. And that's the key of his service. Now his service, how you define service, was in many functions, not just suffering, but in Isaiah we see the picture of the suffering servant. And I don't think Christ's suffering continues. I mean, that he has fulfilled that role of the suffering servant. And thus in Isaiah 61, I hold that that is the servant speaking. That's the same individual that was speaking in Isaiah 49 and 50. But he's no longer that suffering servant that Isaiah saw. We see the triumph and the glory and the good news that comes forth. Now that doesn't mean that in no way he serves us. I think the passage from Luke shows, yes, in the fact that, you know, we will be rewarded and he will share with us his reward in heaven. That is, in a way, service. He still serves us by interceding for us. We know that. So it's not that all service has ended, but he is the triumphant king. He has been given the portion with the great, as God has said, and so that could be made more clear. But I think it's the servant that Isaiah saw in the role of his suffering service, that it doesn't end that way. And I think that was probably important for Isaiah to see and for the people to see. You know, if the prophecy would have ended with the death of Jesus, with the death of the Messiah, you know, what would that have given them to look forward to? So we see that the suffering servant serves a purpose, but there's victory and there's conquest after that.
My only comment is that this was a great lesson.
Thank you.
There's much information here, too much for my mind. So I want to ask, can this be sent through email, the manuscript?
Yes.
So personally, I need to study this, some of the detail. And if it could be, it would be a great value to me and maybe others. Now, I know there's a recording of it, but I'm not much for listening to you. tape recorders. I like to see what I'm studying.
I'd be happy to. Be happy to. And I meant to put it in here. Be happy to send that on to anybody that wants it. A couple references in case you want to do reading. I focused, and there's a lot out there. I focused with three main books or writers. A commentary on Isaiah, done by Edward J. Young. It's a three-volume set. Probably, I think, one of the better. I really enjoyed it. That's a very good one. Homer Haley has a prophecy or a book on the commentary on Isaiah. I'd say that's a great one. Haley is a little bit shorter, but I think Haley writes in a way that almost everybody can understand and follow along with. That's helpful for me. I think most of your congregational teachers could read through Haley and have a very good understanding. And also, the Christology of the Old Testament by Hengstenberg. That's a little bit more tedious, but a lot of good information. So those were the three that I used, and I'm sure there's many others, and you can talk to some of the other brethren, but I would pass that along and happy to supply the notes. I will say with Isaiah, Mike mentioned this with Zechariah, I felt like if I read four or five commentators, somehow I came away with seven or eight different views on some of the things in Isaiah. So it can be an interesting study.
In Isaiah 61:1, this has always kind of intrigued me. You know, when Jesus in Luke 4:18 or thereabouts, when he stood up in the synagogue and they gave him the book of Isaiah to read, the parchment to read. Mm-hmm. He stood up and he read Isaiah 61, fulfillment of this prophecy. He said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because the Lord hath anointed me to preach good tidings unto the meek. He hath sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to them that are bound." And that was repeated in Luke 4:18, I believe, or thereabouts. I want you to comment on that phrase, "He sent me to bind up the brokenhearted." Obviously, to preach the gospel, the spiritual aspect, proclaiming liberty to the captives, as you brought up. But could that say that there is an emotional component to Jesus's mission? You know, we see the spiritual component, deliverance from sin and so forth. But could that "sent me to bind up the brokenhearted," could that be an emotional component to the Lord's mission? Just
excuse me. I'm sorry about this cough. I think in some ways, most definitely, yes. I think in Isaiah 61, now some people argue that this is not the Messiah, but Jesus stood up in the synagogue and read this passage and said, "Today this has been fulfilled." So to me, this is quite clearly a messianic prophecy. This isn't Isaiah speaking in Isaiah 61. This is the servant, again, after his mission has been fulfilled. Now I think that these phrases that are used afterwards, they are prophetic. That Isaiah is, in this prophecy, showing what the work of the Lord is going to entail. And that's in many different aspects. He's going to preach good tidings to the poor. Now that's kind of interesting. And the gospel message was not just for the poor, it was for everybody. But that was something that signified his reign, because the poor, even though they were supposed to be taken care of in Israel, oftentimes weren't. It's always interested me that Jesus, when John the Baptist sends to him and says, "Are you the one we're looking for?" he hearkens back to Isaiah, and he talks about the lame walk and the blind receive sight, and we think immediately of the miracles, but he also says, "And the poor have the gospel preached unto them." Jesus spent his ministry with the poor and the meek. But you think of who are the poor and the meek, especially in society. Typically, they're the downtrodden, they're the forgotten, they're the lost. They're the ones that nobody really cares about, and there's a lot of pain and suffering that comes about through that. But Jesus focused a great deal of his mission with the poor and the meek and preaching the gospel to them. And because of that, binding up the brokenhearted. I think he's healing broken hearts. And that can be emotional, that can be spiritual, that can be the difficulties that these people face. I think we all see this in some way. The gospel is freeing. When you have that hope, when you have no hope, and you get the hope of eternity through the gospel, that's a quite healing thing. And that's exactly what Jesus did. I think it's somewhat poetic language, but yes, I think it's physically, emotionally, spiritually. His work is going to be to people that are lost and need saving.
Anybody else?
Thank you, brother. Really enjoyed it. I appreciated especially the way you pointed out Isaiah's prophecies expressing the deity of Christ, and how that's not a novel idea introduced in the New Testament, but it was prophesied. Mm-hmm. Here is my question. How much of that did the Jews of Jesus' time understand in regard to the Messiah? Especially in light of how in their preaching, often we see strong efforts to prove that Jesus is the Messiah. But we don't see a lot of discussion after that point. Is the Messiah the Son of God? Is he deity? And the high priest in Matthew 26, verse 63 and 64 says, "But Jesus held his peace, and the high priest answered and said unto him, I adjure thee by the living God that thou tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God. Jesus saith unto him, Thou hast said, nevertheless I say unto you, hereafter shall ye see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven." When the high priest asks the question, "Art thou the Christ, the Son of God?" is he there equating the Messiah to being deity? Did he understand that from the prophecies, and he's just asking Jesus, is he the Messiah? Or is he simply basing this on what he had heard Jesus say? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first, as for were the Jews looking for the Messiah to be God incarnate, I think there are some comments made yesterday that show the vast majority of the Jews were not looking for what was actually coming. I think that's really what Isaiah is portraying in the servant as rejected. He's not what people wanted. They looked at him and they turned their heads away. They despised him. I don't think that's because he was ugly. I don't think that has to do with his physical appearance. They didn't want that type of Messiah. They wanted someone to come and throw off Roman authority, and they wanted to be the world power and to enjoy that forever. So I don't think most of them were looking for the right Messiah in the first place. And no, I don't think most of them were probably looking for necessarily God incarnate. But I think that's also the nature of prophecy. Going back to the virgin birth, I've read and I think I've come to the same conclusion. I don't know that very many people, if any people, were expecting the Messiah to be born of a virgin. I mean, it doesn't seem to be. You don't see that in much of Jewish history. Now, Matthew and Luke show that that's what that prophecy signified, and Christ fulfilled that prophecy. But were they looking for that? I don't know. And so with the deity, I don't know that they were expecting that. I think even the apostles, even the disciples, as they were following Christ, it came to them over time. I think back to Mark chapter 4 and 5, when he calms the sea and they say, "Who could this be?" Now, he wielded a power that was more than a prophet. And so even they were learning, this is more than just a man, more than just a powerful prophet. This is the Son of God. Now, the chief priest in his question, I don't think he was asking, this is my view, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think he was asking, "Are you the Messiah?" I think he was asking, "Do you claim to be the Son of God?" Because I can't remember the exact passage, someone can quote it for us here, but in John, we're told that when he said that he was the Son of God, the people sought to stone him because in saying that he was the Son of God, he made himself equal with God. So people say Christ never claimed to be deity. Well, yes, he did. He claimed to be the Son of God, and the Jews sure thought he meant that he was divine because they tried to stone him for it. I think that's what the high priest is getting at. Do you claim to be divine? Do you claim to be the Son of God as we're being told? Now that would, I think, make him the Messiah, quite obviously. They're trying to get him on blasphemy, is what they're doing. They're just trying to trap him into blasphemy. The problem is, it's true, but it's not blasphemy. So I think that's what they're trying to get at there. I don't know that it was them looking at Old Testament prophecies as showing that he was divine, and do you fulfill those Old Testament prophecies? They thought he was blasphemous for claiming to be the Son of God.
Thanks, brother. It was a very informative survey. As you know, I'm sure, of course, among modern Judaism, most modern Jews say that the Messiah was never viewed by Israel as a person, but as the nation. And I know that's not true. There were ancient Jewish groups that looked for a person, but at least the modern Jews all argue that the Messiah was talking about the nation Israel rather than an individual person, most of them. So in the prophecies of Isaiah, what do you think are the best arguments against the nationalistic Messiah that prove the Messiah is an individual person?
That's a good question. I don't know if I'm going to have a great answer. One of the ones that they try and refute the most is Isaiah 7. And there's many ways that they go about that. What you'll find most commonly, and I've never quite wrapped my head around this, even people that claim to be Christians claim that Jesus wasn't born of a virgin, and that wasn't what this passage is talking about, but the word virgin means young maiden. I think Young and Hengstenberg and Haley and many other commentators can get down into the Hebrew very well and make a very good case that the word used in Isaiah chapter 7 is a virgin. This is not a sign given to Ahaz just for that immediate time. This was a prophecy to be fulfilled in a child born of a virgin. That's not a nation. That's not a kingdom. That is a person that is to come. But also, I didn't quite get this, but I think it was Haley made the argument. What Isaiah is doing in chapter 7 is he is prophesying to Ahaz. Ahaz's worry is his reign's coming to an end. Pekah and Rezin want to destroy the Davidic line. And so David's line is at stake here. And he tells him, don't worry. And he tells him to look forward to this time of the virgin-born son. And that's when the kingdom is going to be set up. Well, you would think that the Davidic line would continue at least into the point of the virgin-born son so that it can be set up. Where's the king today? There's no king sitting in Jerusalem from the throne of David, and there hasn't been for over 2,000 years. So if it's national Israel, where's the king? The line was decimated, so all of God's promises to David, I don't think, are fulfilled.
I think that's a great point. Of course, most of the Jews say that the prophecy in Isaiah 7:14 refers to Mahershalal Hashbaz,
yeah.
But I think you've shown that it doesn't. Isaiah 53 always seemed to me to be a very clear evidence that the Messiah is a person and not the nation, because Isaiah says, he was wounded for our transgressions. If he is the nation Israel, who's our? Who's we?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Isaiah's talking, is he speaking for the Gentiles? Or that doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah,
I just wondered if there were any beyond Isaiah 53 that clearly showed this is a person, not Israel, but a person who would do things on behalf of Israel. And 7:14 is a great example. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point of Isaiah 53. And honestly, with all of the servant songs, every single one of those is attacked either by Jews or by critics or modern theologians. One of the most common explanations is the servant is Israel. In fact, there's one in which the servant speaking names himself Israel, but it's clearly not the nation. It's the name and the title that Jacob never lived up to, that Israel as a nation never lived up to. He is the ideal servant, the ideal Israel. Because the question is, at what point in history or at what point in the future is Israel going to meet these qualifications? They've never been the ideal servant. They've never been a light to the Gentiles that is prophesied about. Israel has never been what the servant songs predict the Messiah to be. And so I don't know how it can possibly be Israel.
Okay, we've got three more, and we're going to be out of time. Brother Boone, George Betty, and Alan.
Thank you, Nate. You've done a wonderful job in a great job of answering questions too and talking about things. You brought up Isaiah chapter 8, 13 and 14. Recently, something has become interesting to me about this. It has to do with my lesson later, but I'm not going to talk about it from Isaiah. So I'll talk about it here in your talk or mention it and see if you have a... In Isaiah 8, 13, the Lord of hosts, and that's Jehovah there. And then it says in verse 14, he will be as a sanctuary, but as a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. This verse is quoted, verse 14, a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense in 1 Peter 2, I think it's verse 8. And that's Jesus there. And in the book of Isaiah, Jesus seems to be referred to here, and this is not the first time this happens, but as under the name of Jehovah. And I just wondered if you had any comments on that.
I'll admit I did not spend a lot of time in Isaiah 8, but I did run across that. I think one thing this does do is it does show the deity of the Messiah, because it's quite clear that the rock of offense is the Lord. It's God. And also Christ, and we're taught about the unity of the Trinity in the New Testament, is also that rock of offense. So I don't know that I have a great answer to the question. I mean, contextually in chapter 8, I do think that he is speaking about Jehovah. It doesn't seem to me to be a servant song or a messianic prophecy. It could be, but it's quite clearly talking about God. But it also, you know, it's... I guess this is something my mind doesn't always get around. It's something of faith, I guess. We look at God the Father and God the Son and the Holy Spirit as very different individuals and yet one, but the mission is one, the unity is one, and so the mission of Christ was the mission of God, and so sending Christ was sending that stumbling block, was sending that rock of offense that would come to the people. I guess off the cuff, that's probably the best I can say in regards to that. That's a good question right there.
Very good.
Thank you, sir.
On that last point there, I think we just need to say Jesus is Jehovah.
I think Jehovah is a word like God. Mm-hmm. There's God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit, but there's one God. Jehovah is the same kind of a word. In John 8, Jesus is clearly saying, I am Jehovah. Mm-hmm. He says, I am. And so I think that's a reference to Jesus as Jehovah in the 8th chapter. In the 7th chapter, the point I wanted to notice here is something that Ron and I were talking about when we were over in Africa last year, and I discovered this, or rediscovered it, or something. Anyway, in chapter 7, at the prophecy of the virgin birth, he's saying that in 65 years, Ephraim is going to fall to Assyria. And then he says to Ahaz, ask a sign for yourself from the Lord, your God, ask it either in the depth or in the height above. But then Ahaz says, I will not ask. And then Isaiah says, hear now, O house of David. Mm-hmm. This prophecy about the virgin birth is not to Ahaz and his son. This prophecy is to the house of David, mm-hmm. that is the nation. Mm-hmm. And so, Matthew's interpretation of this prophecy is absolutely correct, and Mahershala Hashbaz had nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great point. In fact, and again, if you look at the Hebrew, when he says, moreover, the Lord spoke again, or verse 14, therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. That doesn't necessarily come across well in English, but in Hebrew, from what I've read, that you is quite clearly plural. It couldn't have been to Ahaz. It's plural. And that is a good point to be made. The sign was rejected by Ahaz. When God gave the sign, he gave it not to Ahaz, but to the house of David. So it is much bigger. I completely agree with that.
And I just want to point out, when we're talking about Isaiah 61, you need to keep in mind that the background of Isaiah 61 is the year of Jubilee, mm-hmm. and all of the requirements for the year of Jubilee, which was typical. Mm-hmm. That's important.
Okay, we thank Nate for a great job, and you're dismissed now for about 15 minutes.